KYW News Radio Original Podcasts. From KYW News Radio 103.9 FM, this is Bridging Philly, connecting our communities on the issues that matter to you. Presented by Gift of Life Donor Program. Register as an organ donor at donorsone.org.
Hello, I'm Raquel Williams. Welcome to Bridging Philly. You may have seen the HBO Max hit series, The Pit. It's a show that gives an authentic depiction of what happens in emergency rooms across the country. One of the characters is a doctor who happens to be neurodivergent. Dr. Wendy Ross is director of the Jefferson Health Center for Autism and Neurodiversity. She was instrumental in developing that character. We sit down with Dr. Ross to talk about autism and neurodivergent issues and how the workplace can help break the stigmas around invisible disabilities.
And I really wanted to change the culture from the ground up.
And Charity Howard is in Old City honoring America 250.
Marines have been trying to rebuild this literally for over 100 years.
All that's coming up on Bridging Philly. Across workspaces, neurodivergent and autistic professionals continue to face barriers that have, well, nothing to do with their talent and everything to do with outdated expectations. Pressures to mask, misunderstandings about communication styles, and persistent stigma around invisible disabilities. But at the same time, organizations are only beginning to recognize the benefits of creating environments where neurodivergent individuals can thrive rather than fit a mold. Dr. Wendy Ross is director of the Jefferson Health Center for Autism and Neurodiversity and a national leader in advancing neurodivergent-friendly design and belonging. She was also instrumental in developing a neurodivergent character on HBO's hit series, The Pit. Along with Dr. Ross is Kelly Ryan. She is a fourth-year medical student from Sidney Kimmel Medical College at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital. Welcome, Kelly and Dr. Ross, to Bridging Philly.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Of course. And Dr. Ross, first question that I'd like to ask you, and I think the audience may need some clarity as well. What's the difference between neurodivergence and autism, if there is a difference?
That is a great question. When we think about autism, we think about three categories: communication, social skills, and behaviors. And the communication can be someone who has no language and no nonverbal communication, even like pointing, for example. Or it could range to somebody who has a lot of language but struggles to have a reciprocal or back and forth conversation. When we talk about social skills, it could be somebody who has no eye contact to variable eye contact to somebody who can not read the room or just misses social cues but has a more subtle presentation. So there's a range. And then when we think about behaviors, it could be something like a special interest that somebody focuses on, or it could be either a sensory seeking or sensory avoidant behavior that helps us either calm down or regulate ourselves.
Yeah.
So that can range from somebody who's rocking persistently to someone who just is really interested in a specific topic.
Okay. So this sounds like all of us. Honestly, to some degree, it sounds like all of us, but maybe it can be more pronounced in other people than others, right?
I think some people do have that perception that we're all sort of on a human spectrum.
Yeah.
I think some autistic individuals would say that they have more intense presentations in each of these categories.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we talk about neurodivergence, that term was coined a couple of decades ago by an autistic Australian sociologist. And it was used to sort of explain that everyone is neurologically diverse or different, but not necessarily less.
Got it.
And we've begun to use that more and more to sort of replace what we used to call Asperger's. But over time, it has often also been expanded to include people with other invisible situations. So ADHD, PTSD, anxiety, kind of those invisible differences that may impact how we interact with the world or process language.
Sure, sure. Understand. And of course, this is Autism Acceptance Month. We've kind of come away from Autism Awareness Month, or we're coming away from that. How did that transition take place?
Well, I think in the past, people used to talk about kind of curing autism. And now we're more understanding that at least for some autistic individuals, you know, we want to welcome them as they are. We want to accept them. And I think it also speaks to this idea that we're not just tolerating people with differences, but we're really creating spaces where we welcome them, whether that be through understanding and sensitivity or our physical spaces.
Right, right. Understand. From your experience, Dr. Ross, what would you say are the most common barriers that people with autism or people who are neurodivergent face when they're entering or advancing in the workplace?
Well, I think, you know, you summed it up so amazingly in your introduction, is that it's a mismatch between the environment and the individual. So that when we sort of can get things closer to where people are comfortable, often they can flourish.
Mm-hmm. Should people declare that I am neurodivergent or, you know, I'm on the spectrum, you know, when they are talking to their employees? Is this something that has to be divulged?
I think that's such an interesting point because sometimes when people have disclosed, they're afraid of a stigma.
Mm.
So sometimes what we've seen is like a don't ask, don't tell philosophy. I did a study with Autistic Doctors International a few years ago, and unfortunately what often happens then is that people don't disclose until really they start to struggle, which sort of perpetuates that stigma.
Right.
So it's sort of like this self-fulfilling prophecy. So I mean, ideally, we would live in a world where people could feel comfortable disclosing. The other thing I want to say is that some people may not know that they're on the spectrum. And often we see this more often with girls and women, but can happen with other people. And that can happen when somebody is academically able to access a curriculum, but social emotionally is a little bit different, right? And so they may not be identified in school or in other places, but then as those expectations increase, as they do in the workplace, things can start to become challenging.
Okay. So is this something that should be diagnosed specifically, or if someone hears, you know, some of the qualities of someone who is on the spectrum and they say, you know what, that sounds like me, or this sounds like my daughter. Is this something that should be diagnosed by a healthcare professional?
To be honest, I'm not sure that we all need a diagnosis. You know, to some extent, as you said, somebody might have some features but not fully meet criteria.
Mm-hmm.
I think what we need to understand is that as a society, we need to be more empathetic and a little bit more patient,
mm-hmm.
and to understand and have this on our radar. But I could have thousands of patients with autism and they could all look different, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not really about the label or the diagnosis. It's about how we appreciate each other as humans.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And that takes me to the language that we use, terms like high functioning, low functioning, like we've been saying on the spectrum, neurodivergent. What language is helpful and what language is harmful?
A lot of self-advocates really prefer to be called an autistic individual.
Okay.
This is not always the same as, for example, somebody with an intellectual disability. Generally, the preferred term is to have a person with an intellectual disability. Things mm-hmm. differ and they can change over time. So sometimes it's important to ask somebody, how do you prefer to be identified or recognized? I also really have gotten away from this idea of high functioning and low functioning
mm-hmm.
because I have had patients, for example, that were completely non-speaking until the age of 4 that are now in medical school.
Right. Okay.
So, you know, if they had been told when they're very young that they were low functioning and I had put guardrails on their potential, I don't know that they would have had the same opportunities to get as far as they have in their education and choices. So I'm really leery about that. And I also think people who might be termed high functioning still can really struggle.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then they're not getting the support that they need. Instead, they're getting sort of negative attribution. So I think it varies in terms of clinicians, but I've really tried to move away from that.
Right. Understand. Kelly, and I'm going to ask both of you this question. I'm wondering, what got you interested in this work?
Yeah, so I have a cousin who is going to turn 40 next month who has cerebral palsy and intellectual disability. And since he was born, my mom became a physical therapist and has worked in special education schools for almost 30 years now.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up going to school with her, volunteering, and spending all the time I could with her at her schools. And then I went to St. Joseph's University for my undergrad. And there we have an autism center on campus called the Kinney Center. And there I was able to support adults and children with autism one-on-one as part of a team as well in a variety of different settings. We did things like recreational activities like swimming, mm-hmm. soccer, basketball, as well as an adult day program, which I primarily spent most of my time There I also studied autism behavioral studies as a minor, and then I also did research with Dr. Joe McCleary there in the cognitive and behavioral interventions lab for the first few years. And then I met Wendy. I met Wendy about 6 years ago through Joe, Dr. McCleary. Working with Dr. Ross over these past 6 years, I've been able to really get involved not only in the Philadelphia community where she has had so many contributions, but also now we see her national reach and even international. Dr. Ross and the Jefferson Center for Autism and Neurodiversity recently hosted an international symposium on neurodiversity and the built environment. And being able to be a part of that and being able to witness her connections internationally even to this population has been such an amazing opportunity and experience.
Okay. Wow. What a glowing way of referring to her. And of course, Dr. Ross, you know, talk about, you know, personally, what sparked the interest in this particular space?
I was working at Einstein in North Philadelphia, which is now a part of Jefferson. So it's all come full circle for me. And a lot of my patients would look typical, but then not behave typically in the community. And so their parents were not able to have typical experiences like going to a museum. And a museum is where kids go to socialize and learn and play. And my patients did not typically do that. And my parents were afraid to go out because when a kid sort of looks like they're misbehaving, people judge the parents, right? And so their worlds were getting smaller and smaller and their siblings weren't going out. And it just really didn't sit right with me. So I actually started to work with museums in Philadelphia, and I presented at the National Museum Conferences, and then the Smithsonian invited us to come and work with them. It all kind of happened organically. Then I had a patient that got stuck on a flight, so I started to work with TSA and airports and airlines, and we had the first mock flight anywhere in the world at PHL, and then my patients could fly independently. And I will say it might be like a little bit of an addiction, because once you get somebody, once you support somebody to do something they didn't think they were going to be able to do, it's a pretty good feeling. So I can't call myself entirely selfless. But and then I started some game day sports programs. It kind of happened organically. And then when I really wanted to be at Jefferson Health. For one reason, because of the mission and vision is to improve lives, be innovative, be inclusive, and do the right thing. And I badly wanted the School of Design because I had been working on processes, but the built environment can be a huge barrier, as we were talking about in terms of the sensory issues. So I wanted to be able to work on the built environment as well as processes. And I really wanted to change the culture from the ground up. So that's why I was so excited to collaborate with St. Joe's in having an early acceptance program for medical students who were knowledgeable and about autism and neurodiversity, because that way we're sort of changing culture, right, from the beginning. And also I wanted the design students to be working with the health students in an interdisciplinary way. And first and foremost, I wanted them reaching out to the community first before they created designs. So in other words, not to design and then as an afterthought ask and then shoehorn. You know what I mean? I really wanted it to be sort of a way of, no pun intended, but like building empathy.
Bridging Philly continues in a moment. Back to Bridging Philly. Connecting our communities on the issues that matter to you.
We're starting to see, or I've noticed at least, that there are more portrayals of people who have autism in the media. And we're starting to see exactly, you know, some of the struggles and issues that take place in the workplace with that in mind. And I'm interested in how you became involved in The Pitt, HBO's hit show The Pitt, where there is, from what I understand, one doctor who is neurodivergent.
So this is such a fun story. I was reached out to by somebody at the University of Southern California who connects experts in different things to entertainment. And she was very nonspecific with the request. It was just a show with a potentially neurodivergent doctor, and they really wanted an authentic portrayal, not necessarily like a savant. And could I meet with them? And it didn't even seem definite at the time that the show had a name or was going to be picked up. So I just logged into Zoom at a designated time, and it was, you know, the person who had connected us, and then it was a writer's room. And then I'll never forget it, in the upper left-hand corner was Noah Wiley.
Wow.
So I had to, like, tamper down all my fangirl tendencies, and it was a really great conversation. I mean, one of the first things I also wanted to do was to connect them with an autistic individual, and I connected them with Jennifer Cook, who's my dear friend also, and she's also on Love on the Spectrum.
Okay, I've seen that.
Yeah, so she's great, and they included everything. They included her liking sort of methodical activities, like debriding something. They'd included her maybe saying something without reading the room, kind of bluntly.
Okay.
It included her sort of, and if you go back and look, you'll see she sort of goes off and fidgets a little or takes a sensory break.
Yeah.
And then in episode 6 or 7, she's the one who's capable of best understanding and helping with an autistic patient. And so all of those things, they were really amazing. They incorporated all of it. And I think it's a credit to the show that they've reached out to other doctors as well on other topics to really make it as authentic as possible.
Right. And Kelly, what are your thoughts on media portrayals of people who are autistic or on the spectrum, and in particular the character on The Pitt as well?
Yes. So actually, The Pitt has been such a great show in highlighting and celebrating neurodivergence. When I first watched The Pitt that first season, I didn't know that Dr. Ross had collaborated on it. I didn't know that she had been a part of it at all. I remember I reached out to her after that episode in which the doctor on the show interacted with the autistic patient.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember watching that with my mother, who's a physical therapist in special education, and we were sitting on the sofa watching it. And we had to pause and rewind. And we just looked at each other and said, wow, we have never seen this type of representation before. We've never seen this type of interaction shown on TV.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I know so many doctors who need to see this.
Right.
I know so many people that all of us are learning from these interactions, and even just the character of Mel in the show. This opportunity of being able to watch The Pitt and celebrate in that and share it all together. I think that The Pitt has such a wide-reaching audience,
yeah,
compared to maybe some other shows in the past. There are some other TV shows and movies that have portrayed autistic characters,
mm-hmm,
but I think that this one really has kind of taken all of the country by storm, and we've all been watching it probably and enjoying and celebrating in the portrayals that we've seen.
I like the way you use the word celebrate,
mm-hmm,
when you refer to this, because that's exactly what this is. Just celebrating the diversity,
mm-hmm,
of thinkers and the way we think. People think differently and handle different things differently. In terms of the stigmas that we were talking about earlier, I wanted you, Dr. Ross, and Kelly as well, to kind of talk about those subtle forms of stigma that show up, especially in the workplace, that people often miss. What are some of the struggles?
Well, I think when someone misses social cues, they might say something that's inadvertently offensive without meaning to say something that offends other people. They might just miss some of those more subtle things that are expected behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
And they might also need more breaks. And then others don't understand, why are you taking a break? But I just want to point out that in the show, there are also other characters that need breaks. Like, you see Noah Wiley go off by himself at one point,
right,
and take a break. So sometimes the way I like to talk about this is, it's not something that is just specifically for the needs of some autistic individuals, but it's also sometimes things that we all need. So like when we think about a ramp, it was created for wheelchairs, but it benefits people delivering things or strollers,
right,
or people with other mobility issues. So to some extent, it's the sort of the care and consideration that some people have to have, but that we all kind of deserve.
And I think, especially working with Wendy after all these years and working on these design projects, it really makes you think when you walk into a space of how a space might be overwhelming for someone with sensory needs,
mm-hmm,
or a space, the lighting is something that might bother someone or might be triggering to someone. Even thinking about my cousin who utilizes a wheelchair, I never thought growing up, I guess, as closely about what places are wheelchair accessible, what places have ramps.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being in public places and not being able to access them with him. So I think that we go through our day-to-day lives and we don't always look at the spaces even around us. But I think that the difficulties encountered in the workforce can start with just our physical surroundings and what's around us.
Yeah. I was going to ask you what support looks like for neurodivergent and autistic employees. And, you know, when you walked into this space, did you have any kind of impression?
I can say this space is actually super cool, but I could see how it might be overwhelming too. Like, especially like when you come to the floor, there's a lot of different colored lights kind of, and it's a very unusual space. There's some ambient noise and it's a very wide open space. There's a lot of things to look at, which could be distracting, but could also be super interesting. And so I could see people being really fascinated by it, but also maybe a little overwhelmed.
Got it. Got it. So what is it that employees can do to support their employees who are on the spectrum or are neurodivergent?
Well, I think one of the first things to do is to have it on your radar. And I think when something comes up that's unexpected, instead of rushing to judgment, to sort of be a little bit more curious and to sort of take a minute and think, why would that have happened? Or what can I do to accommodate that person? Or maybe even just ask them, but ask them with, again, that spirit of curiosity and not judgment.
Many autistic professionals, Dr. Ross, talk about masking to fit expectations. So what does that cost people, you know, over time? And how can workplaces reduce that pressure to mask?
Yeah, so masking is when individuals really watch the people around them and they sort of, for lack of a better term, will act like they see the others do. And it can be super exhausting. I mean, especially if you imagine you're a physician, especially in the emergency room, you have to do all of the medicine and now you have to do it while sort of playing a part. And so a lot of times that can lead to a lot of depression and anxiety. And what we've seen when we ask autistic doctors with this amazing group, Autistic Doctors International, founded by Mary Doherty, is that there is a lot of depression and there's a lot of people dropping out of medicine that are autistic. And there's a lot of people who actually have suicidal ideation and thoughts. So it would be really wonderful if we had a world that was sort of just a little more understanding and if people didn't feel like there was a stigma of disclosing.
Okay. Is there anything that is on the horizon legislatively to help people in the workplace or for more acceptance?
I think when we look at the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is mostly for physical accommodations, it, of course, does technically protect neurodivergent individuals, but there are literally no guidelines. So I think it's really hard. I think it's a really vastly unstudied space. And what tends to happen is people will put in maybe like a sensory room. We see that in a lot of stadiums. But, you know, a sensory room is not a bad option, but it's bad that it's the only option, right? Because it's separate, it's segregated. Surely we can do better, right? Like, so one of the things that we're working on is creating furniture. And we did a line of furniture for our Honickman Center at Jefferson. And we developed it with neurodivergent individuals. And we also included people that were non-speaking by videotaping them and coding their behaviors to make sure that we got as broad a sample as we could as to what was working and what was not working.
Okay. And I was wondering about any advice for parents as, you know, their children are coming up and they kind of see things that are just a little different. And the words that we tend to use, like, what's wrong with him or what's wrong with her? And why didn't she do, you know, things of that nature. What's some advice for parents when they see what may be something that looks like neurodivergent in their kids?
I think that there is help out there. So if the child is school age, they can get some services through the educational system, through special education. If the child is 0 to 3, there's early intervention. So I think there are resources out there. And what I would tell parents, and I know I am a parent, so this is so hard, is, you know, every child has their strengths. You know, when we talk about school, everyone talks about straight A's, but we're not straight A's in life. We either do what we're good at or we love something so much that it doesn't matter. Like, we work hard at it. So I would encourage parents to try not to compare their children to other children, but to compare their children to the changes they see in their own child. And to really just accept their child and help them develop the best they can. And when we think about autism, it's not about changing the child. It's more also about making sure the child has the tools to have a happy life and to reach their potential and to help them have spaces that they can flourish in.
Yeah, Absolutely. And Kelly, as far as your plans, you've done so much studying under Dr. Ross and the like. What are your plans for after graduation?
Yes, so I graduate from Sidney Kimmel Medical College at Jefferson next month.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And then I will go on to pediatric residency. That's a 3-year residency program. And then after that, I hope to go on to a developmental pediatrics fellowship.
Okay. So as we are in this Autism Acceptance Month, you know, what would you say, both of you, is the message that you would want to convey to people, whether they are familiar with this or not, maybe they should learn more? What really is the message?
For me, the message is to be literally accepting and to, I think everyone should feel not even really included, but that they belong.
Yeah.
So it's not like I have something and I might let you in. But to provide grace for those around us, patience and understanding, so that we all feel like we have a seat at the table.
And I would say, like we talked about earlier, in keeping with transitioning from autism awareness to autism acceptance, to celebrate. I love that word in talking mm-hmm. about this population, but just celebrating our differences, celebrating our unique qualities for all of us, and thinking about how we can make each space that we're in, each interaction that we're in, a little bit better, and how we can adapt our own communication styles. We all have different methods of communicating, and just as neurotypicals, maybe, yeah. and people who are neurodivergent or people who are autistic have different ways of communicating right. too. So I think just getting down to a human level of communication is just so important. And like Dr. Ross said, taking that time, having the patience, really striving to connect with those around you.
Yeah, and celebrating those differences, of course. And Dr. Ross, you mentioned belonging. And what does that look like in a workplace? For someone to not just be accepted, okay, well, we know that guy over there. So, but to actually feel like they belong.
Well, one of the things, you know, not to go back to the pit, but, you know, no one really comments on the things that Mel does that may be perceived as a little bit quirky.
Okay.
You know, no one brings it to her attention or mentions it. They just kind of vibe with it, you know? And that was one of the things I asked them to do, was to sort of not make it clear. That either she had a diagnosis or that she knew that she had a diagnosis. And you'll notice no one really singles her out, you know, especially in season one. It sort of just naturally develops over the season okay. that you see more signs.
Well, I have to actually thank you both for shedding light on this subject. How can people learn more about the work you're doing over at Jefferson?
They can check out our website at Jefferson Center for Autism and Neurodiversity. We're also available. We frequently consult people on spaces. We also educate about providing neurodivergent affirming healthcare. So we do give talks and lectures and consultation across a broad range of topics. Our design classes take clients. Mm-hmm. And we also have like an adaptive fashion class, which is super fun. And again, you know, we're really grateful to have students like Kelly who are going to also be out there, you know, helping to change the culture to one of belonging.
Right, right. And Kelly, of course, are you encouraging, you know, other people to, you know, kind of look at this particular space like you are and study that and have more young people jump into this area to have more acceptance and celebrations of
yes,
difference?
Yes, definitely. And I think we're seeing that. I think I have had a lot of colleagues who have been in this sphere and then gone on to different careers and training and things like healthcare. Mm-hmm. And like Dr. Ross had mentioned, as part of the St. Joe's and Jefferson acceptance program that I was a part of, that started, I was the second student accepted to that program. Now there's, I'm not sure the number we're up to, but
we had one graduate so far, we have two or three a year. And that was something I really worked hard on even before I was officially hired at Jefferson, because I really felt vested in this idea of belonging and how early in our careers can we start with that.
And I think that program gives us the opportunity to really have conversations. I've yeah. been able to really have conversations in the classes that I have. At Jefferson, we have a lot of different group sessions where we just have cases that we talk through or different scenarios. And in those conversations, I feel like I've been able to share my experiences and encourage my classmates who may not have had prior experiences working with someone who's autistic or has an intellectual disability to think a little bit differently. And now just seeing how many students we have involved in this program, it's really encouraging to see the interest grow over the years and see we're at least up to 10 people now. It's been really great. And I've been seeing it also in different fields. Being part of the Autism Center at the Kinney Center at St. Joe's, a lot of my colleagues have gone on to different fields, not just working directly in the autism field. Some in business, some in different areas of art, different things like that. And I think that just having that experience and being able to share it, I've seen so many different people, young people, get more involved and get more understanding. And I think with positive media portrayals that we're seeing too, that really gives us an opportunity to kind of have these discussions and encourage people.
Well, that certainly is encouraging, I have to say that. Dr. Ross and Kelly Ryan, thank you so much for joining us and for shedding some light on this subject. I think it's really interesting, and I'm glad we're talking more about it. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Bridging Philly continues in a moment. Back to Bridging Philly from KYW News Radio 103.9 FM.
Welcome back to Bridging Philly. This week on Shara in the City, Shara Day Howard hangs out in Old City, where two Marine vets are honoring America's 250 anniversary by rebuilding an American treasure lost to time. It's one of America's first taverns where the U.S. Navy and Marine Corps got their start.
This week on Shara in the City, we're heading to 2nd Street to meet up with my friend George. He and his Marine buddy are honoring the birthplace of America's Navy and Marine Corps, the Ton. It was America's first tavern, also a restaurant, that happened to be one of the hangouts of George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, and even a well-known pirate. You can almost imagine them doing shots and getting into all kinds of trouble, right? Now, the original Ton was destroyed years ago to make way for progress, you know, roads, highways, etc. But these two guys have dreamed up a way to bring it all back, and they're sharing it with us today. Let's go. All right, they're supposed to be around here somewhere. I'm meeting them on 2nd Street, right off of Market. There's George. How you doing, George?
Fine, Sarah. How are you doing? I'm George Leone. I'm the head of Homecoming 250 Navy Marine Corps that put on the national celebration of the Navy and Marine Corps' 250th last year and is going to keep going, bringing the Navy and Marine Corps back to Philadelphia in the future.
I love it. And this really is the home of the Navy and Marine Corps. And that's there's right. A specific place, right, called the Ton. Tell us about it.
Well, the Ton is a tavern that existed for almost as long as Philadelphia has existed. And it was the birthplace for many organizations, including the United States Marine Corps, and a place where the Navy got one of its starts.
Which leads me to why we're here on 2nd Street between Market and Walnut. George, tell us, why are we here?
We're here because of Pat's vision. I'm going to give him credit that we started out 5 years ago as for the Navy and Marine Corps 250th, and we wanted to rebuild the Ton. After years of effort and searching, we located this property, and with many interested people who want the Ton to be recreated, he purchased this property. And so we're here. We're in the future site of the Ton.
Back to the future. It's That's amazing. Right. And because, of course, the original space is really just on
I-95. Underneath the southbound lanes of I-95.
You had to find a new spot. And yes. This happens to be probably the most realistic spot.
That's right. And it's a great neighborhood for it. With this is Bar Central Philadelphia. So another bar will be a wonderful thing here. And it's very close to the original site. So I think Pat can be very pleased at his efforts to get it here. This is Pat Daly. He is the vice president of the Ton Legacy Foundation.
Well, hey there, Pat. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Ray, the man of the hour. Thanks for joining us today.
Ah, my pleasure. This is the entrance to what is now a parking lot. Ton Alley is actually where we are presently standing. Ton Alley originally was the place where William Penn stipulated that every Philadelphian needed free access to the river.
So tell us a little more about the Ton and what its significance is really here to the history of Philadelphia, to the history of America.
So the Ton was actually one of the very first taverns opened in Philadelphia after William Penn officially started, you know, the settlement.
That's pretty substantial.
It was actually two brothers who built the Ton, the Carpenter brothers. One, Samuel Carpenter, was a wealthy sugar merchant in Barbados. He came here about 6 months after William Penn did because he heard about this Quaker settlement. He was a Quaker himself. Sugar was the oil of its day back then, so it was the most valuable commodity. He decided, hearing about this new place in Philadelphia where you could be a Quaker openly, he decided to cash out and came to Philadelphia. William Penn, having this new colony to develop, was long on paper wealth and short on cash. He was allowed to purchase a pretty substantial piece of the waterfront of the Delaware River.
So where are we talking about exactly? Where they have an idea of Philly and the waterfront. Where was the Ton originally?
The Ton was just north of Walnut Street, south of Chestnut, but closer to Walnut than Chestnut, on the Delaware River, a place then called King Street, later called Water Street. There's nothing left of that now because 95 is there, but if you look at Water Street just north of the Ben Franklin Bridge, if you can find it, but Water Street was actually down on the river. The river is down where 95 is. Front Street sits at the top of a cliff. So they had this large beach down there, and that became Water Street. And that was the most prominent street in Philadelphia, almost the first 60, 70 years of Philadelphia's existence. So that was prime real estate.
Paint us a picture. What could you see on Water Street when the ton was there?
It's very tight. It's only the width of one lane for a car. Back then it was horses and carriages.
When it was hustling, bustling.
The ton was a mariner's tavern. So it was often the place where sometimes the first people set foot on land in America from Europe. The ton was the first pier built into the Delaware. So the ton was at the end of the pier. So it wasn't quite an Ellis Island, but it was certainly the first arrival place of a lot of immigrants to this country. Probably the most famous regular at the ton was Benjamin Franklin. The ton is recognized as the oldest Masonic lodge, the first Masonic lodge in North America.
So you see a lot of carriages, a lot of people. Who's walking and talking there?
Quite a few merchants. Samuel Carpenter, although he was a sugar merchant in Barbados, here he became a developer and a logistics expert. Built warehouses and a tavern at the ends. His brother Joshua was a master brewer, so he ran the tavern and actually ran it as a brewery. And became quite wealthy. He actually was one of the very first subscribers that raised the money to build Christ Church, which stands about a block north of here. I was a Marine officer myself, and you always hear Tun Tavern when you're in the Marine Corps. Everything is about the Marines being done in Tun Tavern, and every year it's reinforced because there's a big birthday celebration on every Marine base worldwide. And so I thought, you know, Marines come to Philadelphia now looking for this place. Philadelphians don't know why they're here, but they come by the thousands. So why not rebuild it? Why can't it be here? And that's what started all this 10, 12 years ago. This particular space is good because we border Black Horse Alley, which is a little, you know, 4 or 5 foot wide cobblestone alley next to our property that has been there since 1686, I believe, 1687. So it was here at the time of the ton. It would have been a very short walk from the ton to here.
So this is a literal upgrade.
This is an upgrade. Yeah, we're above the high water mark here. So I think we'll be all
goals.
Right from flooding.
Exactly. Tell us, what's the ETA here in terms of building it?
Well, we couldn't build exactly what we believe it looked like because it's way too small. You know, back then, Philadelphia had at most 25, 30,000 people, which was still the second largest city in the Western Hemisphere after London. But still, it wasn't that big of a on today's terms.
So where are you guys walking me over to?
So this is a sign in front of the space where the actual tavern will be built. Here facing 2nd Street, oriented exactly as it was when it was down on Water Street. The front of the tavern is facing west, the back of it to the river. The tavern will be approximately 50 feet long by 30 feet deep. If we were to build the ton as it we believe it looked, it probably only fit, by our architect's guesstimate, 82 people in it.
Yeah, that's happy hour.
Yeah, so there'll be a restaurant behind it. And in the Lord of Tun Tavern, at one time, it was called Peg Mullen's Beefsteak Club because it was known for the finest steak and seafood in Philadelphia, and most of the Continental Congress dined here, and they bragged about how great it was. That's why a lot of organizations like the Freemasons were founded in Tun Tavern, because it was large enough to accommodate them, and they could have large meetings and gatherings, dinners there. Society of St. George, St. Andrew's Society, Friendly Sons of St. Patrick, they all use the ton as their meeting place. And there's some evidence that Blackbeard the pirate also visited the ton when he came secretly, discreetly into Philadelphia in the very early 1700s, about 1712. He was seen less than a block from here.
Get out.
Yes. So people who had seen him before were confident that's Blackbeard. And so he may actually make an appearance at the ton now and then to engage.
So you walk through the doors. What do we see?
Make it look 300 years old the day it opens, but bigger. A lot of repurposed wood. The ton will run as a full-on nonprofit. So every dollar that this raises through operations, we donate to veteran charities, to Masonic charities like Shriners Hospitals.
Amazing. So how can Philly help you get this done?
This is a full-on nonprofit. Every contribution we get is tax deductible.
Community effort.
It truly will be a community project, and it's going to bring a tremendous amount of tourist dollars that don't come here now. I can tell you as a Marine, this is Mecca. Every Marine is dying to see this place. Marines have been trying to rebuild this literally for over 100 years.
So how can we help build a dream?
Go to our website, thetun.org, to help us build this, or just make a donation. We will pave Tun Alley with etched bricks from donors. So you'll get the feeling that you're back in the early 1700s.
Thank you for joining us. Bridging Philly is brought to you by Gift of Life Donor Program. Register as an organ donor at donorsone.org. For more information on Bridging Philly, follow KYW News Radio on social media. And if you have any ideas for interesting features that you'd like to share, feel free to get in touch with us at bridgingphilly@kywnewsradio.com. For Sharaday Howard and our producer Sabrina Boyd-Circa, I'm Raquel Williams. Be well.